now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Hello, I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and welcome to The Game Podcast, the Peter Crouch's right boot of podcasts, says my producer and Crouchy fetishist. I brought my A game today, and I'm joined by something of an A team too. Julianne Lawrence, Rory K. Smith, and from a secret location in lovely, lovely Barnes in West London, it's Mr. Matt Dickinson. In a little bit, we'll be getting into Rangers and Scotland and taxes and all that good stuff. But first, let's start at the Britannia. All right, since, as you can tell, our producer who writes my scripts has already referenced it because he loves extremely tall men who can strike things hard from far away. Let's start from Peter Crouch's goal, since everybody seems to be convinced that this could be is the instant goal of the season. And I'm told that there's some people who are debating whether it's the greatest volley in Premier League history. Apparently, Dicko, your boy Gary Neville's been asked to weigh in on this one. I'm sure he won't make the mistake of saying that it was, and instead will credit Paolo Di Canio's famous volley instead. But what's your assessment? When we see this, obviously it's great to watch, but is it the kind of thing where it's one in a million, or is it something, do you think, that he really practices in training and I suppose pulls off more often than not?
We didn't try it that more often than not. I mean, he's done a few of them, and Crouch is, you know, he's hit a few spectacular volleys, but it had a whiff of Justin Fashanu against Liverpool for me. The ball is sitting up nicely. Let's have a swing, and I can't imagine he thought through the precise trajectory as it flew over Joe Hart. But yeah,
I have to jump in here because I'm getting a very confused look from Rory Smith, probably because he's 23 years old and this was way before his time. But Justin Fashion, do you want to explain it? That was a goal of the season he scored, I believe, for Nottingham Forest against Liverpool many years ago.
Yeah, although was it for Norwich? He basically had the back to goal ball teed up, and he'd been in wretched form and couldn't sort of normally shoot straight from 2 yards. And he suddenly just sort of back to goal swiveled and hit this volley that flew in the top corner. And everyone thought, where on earth did that come from?
He's rushing off to YouTube now to check it.
I'm less surprised by Crouch doing it than the instant assumption that this suddenly makes him bound for Euro 2012. Crouch is in the team 18 to score goals, but he's also in a team to be part of a successful England team, and his pattern has not fitted for, you know, pretty much four or five managers apart from an impact substitute. One wonder goal does not an England striker make, I'm afraid.
Well, let's digress very, very briefly on the England striker debate, because I'm sure we have plenty of time on this. If you are the mind that you need to bring at least one non-midget among your strikers, one big man, and Peter Crouch is, I presume, in the mix. I mean, the other candidate, well, first of all, actually, does anybody believe that you don't need to take at least one big man? Anybody oppose?
Nope.
Okay, so everybody agrees that you need to take one big man.
Yep.
Are Crouch's chances that bad, Dicko?
I don't think they're bad. I just think, Welbeck goes, obviously Rooney goes, Sturridge will go. Walcott will go as sort of half, mostly as a winger. But
those are all little fellas, though. I mean, do you need a Carroll, Crouch?
Welbeck's not little, but then, and I think you are down to one of, you're always going to be down to one of Bent, Carroll, or Crouch. Now, Bent, obviously, Bent's injury, Bent probably, you know, on recent selections would have been favourite, although maybe less so if Harry Redknapp's manager. So you maybe are down to Carroll v. Crouch. And okay. I would say, the one thing I would just say is that Crouch, you know, Crouch is very good at what he does, but what he does every time the ball is, he's not a target man, and when the ball is played up to him, he takes it down, he tends to move back towards his own midfield 5 yards, and tends to slow the game down that way, and that's why successive England managers haven't picked him. He's not a flick-on man, his height is often very misleading. He's not an Emil Heskey, which some might say is a good thing, but managers have found has not worked for them.
As one of those who'd say that the fact that he's not Emil Heskey is a good thing, it's surely the fact that he's not a flick-on man, as Matt quite rightly observes, is to the benefit of the way England play football. England's curse for years has been the fact that you see someone who's over 6 feet tall, you lump it forward at them, and surely the fact that Crouch has the technical ability to bring the ball down, bring players into play, and sort of plays the fulcrum of an attack is a bonus.
Well, it depends who you play. I mean, obviously Michael Owen, you know, absolutely loves playing with Emil Heskey for reasons of partnership, you know, and so, you know, clearly it depends who you're playing off or with Crouch. But, you know, I'm just saying that, you know, during the Owen era and even subsequently, Crouch did not suit the way England wanted to build up their attack and tended to slow things down too much for managers who, you know, England didn't have the creativity to break mass defences down, so they had to hit on the quick break, and Crouch is not a quick break man.
Alright, I think we've sort of exhausted the Peter Crouch subject for the next 10 years, although I should point out that nobody's brought up Bobby Zamora as a candidate, which is...
because he's rubbish.
There you go. That's very, very respectful. So moving on to Manchester City, and obviously this result, well, as we speak now, Monday, they're top of the table on goal difference. Obviously, United have that goal in hand and go 3 ahead. We love to talk about mind games and Sir Alex Ferguson. I guess this goes back to the time he upset Kevin Keegan in the mid-90s, or maybe Keegan upset himself. But we had a little bit of this going on this week, and it was instigated by your fellow cheese-eating surrender monkey, Patrick Vieira, who, of course, comes out and says that United were a little bit desperate in bringing back Paul Scholes halfway through the season. And then, of course, Sir Alex, you know, reels him in hook, line, and sinker and says, oh, well, desperate is Carlos Tevez, blah, blah, blah. Now, we've been told that Mancini just laughed it off. I don't know if he laughed it off in a jokey way or in like an insane, like freakish, like they're coming to get me paranoid way. Julian, yeah, you know Patrick Vieira. I mean, I know him too. I don't think he was trying to wind anybody up when he said it.
I don't think so. And I think, to be fair, it's a good point as well. For Fergie to go and get Scholes back, it's clearly because he had a problem somewhere in midfield.
Because he's desperate.
No, but maybe because it was injuries, but I think more because he was not working at that time. And clearly Scholes made things work much better for United. But at some point, you know, getting a 37-year-old man out of retirement clearly shows that there was something going wrong there. And he has worked, and I don't think Patrick was trying to upset anyone or to start some mind games with Fergie at all. I do think that mind games are a myth, though. I don't think they win you or lose you in game at all.
No, I'd go along with that. I think it's, as you say, the whole mind games thing goes back to Keegan. There is no other example of mind games working.
Okay, now...
are we saying that is an example of it working? I mean, I think we overplay them and they become this hoary old thing, but you know, they must say something about a guy's management style, about his management effectiveness. I think maybe they're overplayed, but they reveal something.
But do you think when Mancini will make his team for the next game, he will think, oh God, Fergie just said this or just said that?
I think it's more they can reflect, you know, the way a manager is exuding confidence or brittleness is part, you know, teams, individuals tighten up when the pressure comes on. And What is said in the media can reflect, you know, whether a team is confident or is tightening up.
Well, actually, and this is my second Gary Neville reference of the day. He actually sent an interesting tweet on precisely the subject today. I don't know if you saw it, Dicko, but I would agree with you, though, that I don't think, though, Keegan's the only example. In fact, and I don't know if the skit's going to work via audio, but I remember somebody there with a whole stack of papers going, fact, fact, fact.
Sure. Liverpool won 10 of the next 12 games.
You know what? Okay, you know what? Sorry. Who is having Tony Evans here? We've got the Yorkshire version.
No. It's a fact. Yes.
And then they won lots of titles and whatever. But, okay.
So I would say that having Nabil Elzar on the bench was a greater factor in that title race than Ferguson getting at Rafa.
Dicko, can you sort the young man out, please?
Well, the facts were that Liverpool went on a winning streak. Yeah, and I agree that, you know, I'm not saying it's not the first factor, the second factor, or the fifth, but it can reflect where a manager's mind is, and therefore, you know, if a manager's walking around and he is tense, he is wrapped up in what the media are thinking or trying to react to the media, that can transmit through we all know cultures are created from the top and often reflect a manager, and there's no doubt that a lot of managers spend a lot of time thinking about the media, probably too much.
I think that's all true. I think Dicko's absolutely right that it does reflect a manager. I'm not sure, I agree with you, Leon, though. I'm not sure how much it affects the other team. I think it would well, seeing their manager so sort of ebullient in confrontation, it would well give United's players an extra dose of confidence. But I don't think Man City's players are reading the papers.
No, well, not the English papers anyway. Except for Gareth Barry, actually. He strikes me as more
Gareth Barry,
a bookish type.
Loves the Sudoku in The Independent.
Does he?
No idea. No,
okay, all right. Stop picking up other newspapers. I think it's what I notice reading media in different countries in this nation, we always love like a narrative and characters in our narrative, and you know what, and the mind games notion sort of fits perfectly into that. It's the idea that, you know, ultimately you win titles by being mentally stronger, and you know, you get into people's heads. All right, let's move on to Stamford Bridge, Chelsea and Spurs. A lot of people saw this as Chelsea's best chance to get back into the hunt for the top four. It didn't work out that way. It was 0-0. But before we get into the game, it was an absolutely fetid first half. I listened to sort of the radio and watched some of the stuff afterwards, and they're asking the players, like, how could you cope with the heat out there and whatever. Now, I should point out, I live very close to Stamford Bridge. And yes, it was sunny. It might have been, what, 20 degrees, 22 degrees, 25 degrees at most, but it wasn't. What is it with you people and the heat? I know you're all sort of pale, pale. I mean, I'm looking at you, Rory, because this is what I don't understand, right? You always talk about, like, all of a sudden, like, it gets past 20, and it's like the heat, we can't cope. But then in the summer, you go out there and you sit all day, yeah, on the cricket green, right? Up in Yorkshire and stuff like that, where you're from?
Absolutely, yeah.
But I'll tell you what,
Gab, it never hits 20 degrees in Yorkshire, I can assure you of that.
All right, fair enough. But is this just like a stupid thing that we say? Like, does anybody really think that the heat could have affected anything about that game whatsoever?
What's really stupid is that...
English preoccupation. It's ever since Paul Scholes ran out once in a summer tournament and everyone thought they sort of literally saw him melt and fry in his with his pale skin and his ginger head, we've all become paranoid about English footballers going out in sunshine.
We all overreact to the weather. There's no, I mean, if you walk around any English city this weekend, there's loads of people with their tops off and in tiny little sort of shorts and stuff. It's March. It's 19 degrees in March. The really stupid thing is that most of the players on that pitch were foreign. Thinking it's freezing. running out in gloves and long sleeve t-shirt.
Long sleeves as well.
I saw Yunus Kabul singing. Yeah. Looking very, very upset at how hot it was. But no, I know, whatever. I just thought it was completely, completely demented. But anyway, Julian, why was that first half so terrible? All season long, we're talking about, you know, the crash bang wallop of the Premier League, and isn't it great? All the big sides face each other, and it's 8-2 and 5-4 and 3-5. This first 45 minutes were about as defensive and just horrible and unimaginative as I've seen.
There was so much at stake, maybe, that especially on Chelsea's side, but I thought when they went to City as well...
We blamed Di Matteo then.
No, it's not that. I did think, even when they went to City as well, and on Saturday, they were playing for not to lose more than to win, to be fair. And the first half, they just tried to... They stayed, you know, well-organised, didn't try to go forward too much. And Tottenham just had the ball and sometimes they didn't know what to do with it apart of the last minute of the first half. And it was just like a really weird game when neither of the teams looked like they wanted to win it, to be fair, or at least not lose it.
I mean, the City part I can understand because I think the plan was, let's go to City, get a point, then we beat Spurs at home and Bob's your uncle and we're 1 point behind them and we're fine. Now, obviously, the City part didn't work out because they lost and this didn't work out. As a game plan, it was all right, but you have to do more, especially when Spurs seem to happily conceding the ball in the first half, but in the second half, they had the most possession.
They did. I mean, Spurs looked the better side throughout, I think. They weren't, neither side would want to remember that first half, as you say, but Spurs were the better team. Chelsea just, I think they were caught between two stools. They knew that if it was 8 points, that was them gone. And Chelsea, of all those big teams, can't afford to be without the Champions League at all. If Chelsea aren't in the Champions League, Chelsea are kind of nothing. So
what happens if Chelsea aren't in the Champions League? What's giving this doomsday scenario?
Well, I mean, who signs for Chelsea? What's the attraction of signing for Chelsea if they're not in the Champions League?
Hazard would definitely not go, for example.
Yeah, exactly. 150 grand a week. You get a chance to live in West London. I mean,
but if you got the choice between, there's only sort of how many top players are there in the world? Who Chelsea and City?
37.
And all those,
I mean,
yeah, 37.
What kind of question is that?
There are 37 top players in the world who are available for transfer this summer. And if you've got the choice, they're all the big teams are looking at the same players. Why would you go to Chelsea? It's not like if United missed out on the Champions League and you could say, well, you want to play for Manchester United. It's not like if Harry stays at Spurs and you say you want to play with Modric or Bale or play in that attacking style. What is the attraction of Chelsea if they're not in the Champions League?
The fact that it's
apart from the fact they can pay you money.
The fact that it's West London and not White Hart Lane and you don't have to go and...
Well, there's not that many Spurs players who live on Tottenham High Road. I'm not sure if that's...
Doesn't Benoit Suakoto take public transport to get there?
There's a few players who
still that's
the
myth.
Matter takes the tube around.
Yeah, but not to White Hart Lane.
Not to White Hart Lane. Exactly. Well, he might go shopping.
Yeah,
might go to Brent Cross.
White Hart. Yes. As Skinner's telling me in my ear, there isn't a tube there, you northerner. At White Hart Lane. You have to take some of that weirdo train.
It's the Overland, yeah.
Or the bus.
Yeah, Overland from Liverpool Street.
Walk from Seven Sisters.
Walk from Seven Sisters.
It's a long walk, though, Skinner. It's a long walk.
All right. Enough for this rubbish. Let's move on to actual football. Dicko, what you say of Harry and of this run, it's seven games, it's one win, and that was against Stevenage. Now, I actually think Spurs have played quite well in several of those games, but they're not getting the results. You've historically been the single biggest Harry Redknapp advocate in the English media. How does this colour...
That's joke. Joke alert.
How does this move on the conversation of Harry in England at all, these last seven games? Does it? Should it?
No, it shouldn't alter it at all. Although it is sort of classic English way of things that he will probably be appointed England manager in the week when they've lost another six games and finished fifth or sixth or seventh or something, just to sort of throw the media story, lurch it back the other way. But no, he should be England manager, not because he's going to turn us into world beaters, but because he's the next man in line, and they want to go with an English manager, and if they do, he's the obvious candidate. So
this run doesn't say anything.
No, it doesn't. I mean,
it's not worrying or anything.
Well, it's a bit worrying for Spurs fans because I agree with you. I don't think they've played desperately. I mean, for a period against Man United, the scoreline said different, but they were in that game. It does raise questions about their conditioning over the season. Someone, no doubt, will come up with stats, but I think there are signs that Harry's teams have faltered at this time before, and say that does raise questions about conditioning.
Sure, I want to ask about that, though, because how much of that down to the man? I mean, I'm assuming he's got in his sort of old, endless staff of Kevin Bonds and Les Ferdinands and Tim Sherwoods, I'm assuming he's got...
It sort of directly comes to him, but obviously, part of a manager's skill, they have a lot of control at clubs, and especially English clubs, and part of that skill is delegation and making sure you've got the very best staff around you. And Tottenham are a big enough club that they certainly should have no excuses for lacking in sports science.
So, Harry's training is famously light. his own coaching staff admit that they don't do a lot of, you get team people like Martin O'Neill who do loads of fitness work, really drive the players hard. Harry doesn't, and there's a balance to be struck. So O'Neill's sides collapse in March as they're knackered, and Harry's sides collapse in March as the other teams kick on. They're built, their stamina's built over the season, as you know, Dan.
You might notice Julian and I giving you quizzical looks. Where we come from, you have a fitness coach who deals with the fitness side of matters, and your actual manager or coach deals with other matters. Is it fair to blame Harry Redknapp's?
Where we come from as well, the manager turns up for training every day, which is not Harry's case. So I don't know.
Okay, but Tim Sherwood does. We've all met Tim.
Yeah, Sherwood. That's not Sherwood's job. Sherwood's not in charge of fitness. Sherwood
would it be coaches? Yeah, he's there.
No, he's there to bring the players through from the youth teams to the reserves and into the first team. Bond and Joe Jordan take training.
To be fair, the Spurs players on Saturday didn't look like they were running out of steam at the end of the game.
No,
they
were not, actually it,
more despite that horrible heat.
I don't think it's that they don't have 90 minutes fitness. I think it's that the team, certainly foreign managers, build their teams so that the way their conditioning works. I don't understand the science of it. Is that in March when the season gets really hard,
and
when
you're
knackered,
they
peak
times
at certain times.
Yes.
Yeah.
Harry doesn't do that, and that's what happens. It's not that they drop off; it's just that they're not as fit as everybody else is.
And Bale's not had any. Bale's been moved, shunted around a bit over the last few months. I mean, there was a virtue in it early in the season where we saw him popping up almost as a sort of classic number 10, and chipped in with a few good goals. But he just seems to have, he's been moved around and not always effectively. I mean, I remember at the Arsenal game, he was. He sort of seemed to try a few positions and just never once got into the game. But they're not. Look, they're, you know, their run of results is not at all clever. But they're not playing that badly, and certainly they were the better team on Saturday. So they are very capable still of finishing top four.
Just talking about the Bale positioning, I do believe that Harry made some tactical mistakes along the line in that bad run. I think he played Modric on the left, for example, against United, where he was completely useless because that's not his position, and you've got one of the best central midfielders in the country. You play him on the left, you know, it's like, well, may as well play him left back then, or right back, or something like that. And I do believe that Harry has messed things up as well tactically in those games. Yes, they didn't play too bad. I'm sorry, you can't play well and not win, you know, that many times as well. At some point they made some mistakes, and I think tactically he got some things wrong.
The other thing I'd
which
say
I
about
agree it's quite a sort of surprise, because the one thing you would associate with him, he tends to pick pretty well balanced teams, and I certainly remember that Arsenal game. It was the team just looked, and the changes actually imbalanced it even more. So yeah, no, I agree. I think he's made mistakes, but then. Even Harry makes mistakes.
In Harry's defence, I thought what he did on the right hand side against Chelsea on Saturday was quite clever. He played Van der Vaart there ostensibly, but then you had Sandro in a sort of.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Like a right half back position, I guess, so that as soon as Van der Vaart decided he couldn't be arsed getting back, Sandro would cover for him. The other thing I'd say about Bale, he reminded.
It's easy to do when you play one up, unlike the two of us played previously, which doesn't always work.
The thing about Bale against Chelsea particularly reminded, and I've seen Spurs, I think I've seen them in 4 of the 5 games they've lost, or in their bad run, and Bale reminds me of Steven Gerrard at his worst. When he gets the ball in that in that middle third just inside the opponent's half, and he looked, you can see him look at goal and he thinks, this is my job, I run towards the goal and I shoot from distance, and that's all Gareth Bale did on Saturday. I think the fact that he's been moved around so much by Harry maybe has him believing his own hype a little bit.
Some of you might say that's confidence. I guess it's six of one, one half dozen of another. Just to wrap this up, I need your percentage chances for fourth place. I'm assuming we all agree that Arsenal are going to be in the top four. So feel free to include Chelsea, Spurs, or Newcastle. Julian?
I go...
All right, have a think about it since it's been forever. Rory, okay.
That's just what French people do before they speak.
You too. Come on.
Everybody should be
professional. Dicko, I'm going to start with you since you're a professional. Percentage chances, please.
The start of the season, I predicted Spurs.
No, percentage chances now, not the start of the season.
percentage chances now, I would say Tottenham have got 50%. I would say Chelsea have got 40% and Newcastle 10%.
Thank you. See, boys, that's how it's done.
Spurs 75, Chelsea 24, Newcastle 1.
Ooh, George Culkin appreciates that.
Spurs 60, Chelsea 40.
Hey, you don't even consider Spurs.
No.
Newcastle. All right, well done. In our debate this week, we're going to go to an exotic location north of the border, and that is Scotland. Unless you've not been paying attention, it's a remarkable case in Scotland involving Rangers. Well, several cases, in fact. The club, of course, are in administration. They've been docked points. They've had a change in ownership. They're involved in two big tax cases with the revenue, which potentially, we don't know how things work out with the tax man, but, could end up costing them even more money. And at the weekend, Celtic faced Rangers at Ibrox. Celtic had a chance to win the title at Ibrox, and it was just one of those, humdrum old firm games where nothing much happened, with Rangers somehow winning 3-2, three players getting sent off, two for Celtic and one for Rangers, and Neil Lennon, the Celtic manager, getting sent off as well. Now, Dicko, you were up in Glasgow. You spent some time north of the border. Let's start with the game, actually. Get that out of the way. I'm assuming you've been to Old Firm games before. What was the atmosphere there compared to this one?
My ears are still ringing, that's for sure. But it was a surreal one. It was strange. It wasn't... And clearly, there is hostility. But actually, Celtic fans were determined to party come what may. So even when they were losing 3-0, they were sort of joining in Rangers songs and pretending to celebrate Rangers goals and thinking, well... deep down, this is hurting, but we're not going to show it because we're 21 points clear. And Rangers fans were loving the moment, celebrating like mad, but also knowing they're going to wake up this morning still in about 90 million quid worth of debt. So it was a slightly odd atmosphere, and not sort of full of venom in the way that I've experienced one or two before.
Now, Neil Lennon was sent off. I've met Neil Lennon on more than one occasion, just before he became Celtic manager, and I found him to be intelligent, charming, and actually really a really really lovely guy. And I'm not saying he's not a lovely guy because he was sent off, but I just think of the stress that he's under. And remember, this is a guy who, of course, has had death threats and whatever else, and. And I'm trying to understand, why does he continue putting himself through this as a Celtic manager, to the point that, he gets himself sent off, in a game like this, when, what do you make of this, Dicko, and his sort of emotional investment? Because there's a part of me that says, I don't need to win the title here at Ibrox. They're going bust. I've got a billion-point lead. I'll still win it next week. What is it, do you think, about him and about the situation that just pulls you in so much?
Well, it's a double-edged thing. I mean, he's clearly got a huge sort of competitive pride, and that was hurt by seeing his team underperform so badly. But equally, he's got a relish for confrontation. The last time Celtic had two players sent off,
in an Old Firm game. He was one of them, and it was for arguing with a referee. Yeah, I was at the press conference on Friday, and someone said, oh, you know, how are you going to handle the atmosphere? They're all going to be after you. And his response was, I love it. That tells you everything.
He thrives on spite, Lennon, I think. He seems to be a sort of integral part of the Old Firm rivalry, and he's a boyhood Celtic fan. He comes from Northern Ireland, which is obviously, they feel it almost as much as they do in Glasgow, in Northern Ireland, the Rangers Celtic thing. And he just seems to, you don't want to blame him. You don't want to say that a victim of such sort of ridiculous and horrific and equal measure things could in any way be culpable. But at the same time, you do wonder whether Lennon could act differently and maybe try and take the. I think it's as someone who's got Scottish heritage, I would quite like Scottish football not to be a joke. And I think central to that is Rangers and Celtic sort of sorting themselves out, not just financially but sort of morally as well, and stop indulging in the ludicrous side of the derby. And Lennon, I think, encourages it.
He's become to the Old Firm what Mourinho is to El Clasico, but with a sort of sectarian twist to it. I mean, he loves to be this sort of lightning conductor for all the angst around it. And I think Rory's spot on. You know, you can't hold him culpable, but he is part of this sort of. The good side of it, the nice side of it is pantomime. The worst side of it is clearly pretty damn ugly and horrible, and he is part of the perpetuating of it.
The whole issue is quite bizarre to me, having known, I knew Tommy Burns, a former Celtic manager, who was really into, obviously really felt this very, very strongly. I still know Lorenzo Amoruso quite well, who was a Rangers captain, and from people on both sides, I view this from afar with a mixture of fascination and sometimes horror. But I want to broaden this out, because if you can just sum up the Rangers' tax and financial situation and its implications briefly for those who might have missed it, Dicko.
And whether
you think there's a broader risk for other clubs in England and across Europe.
Essentially, it's two areas that they're in deep trouble. Obviously, there was the owner, Craig White, who bought the club last May for £1, did it by using season tickets for the next few seasons.
Sorry, jump in here. So basically, there's a company that, just correct me if I'm wrong here, there's a company, he went to this company and he said, hey, lend me a bunch of money and I will pay you out of the season ticket revenues for the next couple of seasons.
So he literally sold four seasons worth of half the season tickets per season, 25,000 tickets per season. He sold to a company for 25 million, and he used 18 million of that 25 to pay down the debt he inherited from when he bought the club from Sir David Murray. So there was a sort of, shall we say, financial sleight of hand, which is still being investigated by the administrator and quite possibly even the Strathclyde police. On top of that, he hasn't paid a penny of tax since his takeover. He took it from the pay slips, but never actually passed it on to the tax man. So they're talking 15 million of that, which is what forced administration. And to cap it all, when he bought the club, he inherited the big tax case and the wee tax case, which are stretched back over a decade of Murray's reign. Effectively, they were paying players. Allegedly, they were paying players through these EBTs, offshore trusts. And the great debate about that is whether that was effectively salary by a different name, or whether it was, as Murray claims, a discretionary payment and therefore not liable to tax. And a tribunal will rule on that in the next month, and it potentially means a 50 million liability to Rangers if they lose that tribunal. And the ramifications of losing it are endless.
I think it's football as a mirror of society, isn't it? That we live in a country where we're looking after the interests of the rich more than the interests of the poor. We're robbing grannies to pay the billionaires. People are either introduce an austerity budget, and then you've still got the people who've got the most money shifting all their money offshore. We live in a free market.
What does that have to do with Craig White, though?
Vulture capitalist society, and we run our football clubs like that.
Well, maybe if Craig White were rich and the government was looking after his interests, he wouldn't need to go and take money from ticketers to go and create this house of cards to buy Rangers. He could have just bought it out of his own pocket.
That's very true. I think David Murray has to be looked at as well, without even leaving aside the legality of the tax payments. As Ditto says, that's sort of that's subjudice, saying I don't want to talk about it, I'll get in trouble. But they spent way beyond their means for 15 years. This is what happened, and that's the problem.
Okay, so Ditto, I just want to clarify this, because I think this is the one area of this whole case which is a lot of relevance, I think, to people south of the border as well. And to my producer, Chris, please keep this bit in the show. Which is this, right? These EBTs, these forms of these offshore trusts, which are used to make discretionary payments to footballers, they were very popular with Premier League clubs not that long ago. And basically, in a nutshell, for those who don't understand, footballers would sign these big image rights contracts, and they would sell their rights to these fictional offshore companies, and then the clubs would pay the money there, and so they'd basically be getting the money almost net, and it was a way to pay people more money and avoid taxes and save yourself money. Now, many clubs did this, and many clubs, and if you remember, it came out, I believe, in Ray Parler's divorce case, that Arsenal were one of them. When the tax man said, hey, you can't really be doing this, as I understand it, the clubs in England changed the way they paid their players.
Well, I think there are slight differences. I mean, we had a good story a couple of weeks ago, Ashling, about Manchester United settling with a taxman over image rights. I mean, there is some discussion about how far you can pitch the image rights. You know, does it seem fair that, for example, 10% of Rooney's income, you know, the value of that compared to his basic salary? And I think, to be honest, that has largely been a degree of haggling between clubs and the taxman about, you know, should image rights represent 5%, 10%, or 20%? The difference, as far as I'm aware, with Rangers is that this wasn't called image rights or anything like it. It was this bizarre discretionary payment. I mean, EBTs are meant to be sort of loans, effectively, and I think this is a whole different area, which is why HMRC are pursuing it so vigorously.
The key thing, which doesn't add up for me here, right, is I'm assuming Rangers have accountants and things like that, and obviously a lot of complicated tax stuff is they're gray issues, right? The gray areas, rather. There's two things I don't add up. First of all, if Rangers were doing this, I'm assuming their accountants were saying it was okay to do it, and their tax lawyers were doing it, and they were doing this after talking to HMRC, who told them, yes, this is okay. And secondly, if all other clubs knew Rangers were doing this and it was a way of saving yourself money, if all other clubs looked at it and thought it was okay, why wasn't anybody else doing it? I mean, I believe Celtic was all given the possibility of doing it, and they decided not to do it.
It comes down to scale, doesn't it? I mean, I think, you know, the tax man can say, we'll haggle to settle a case with one person who they think has, you know, maybe pushed their luck, because there are huge grey areas in taxation, whereas they will pursue more vigorously someone who they think has taken the PIWS. So it can often be degrees of scale, can't it? You know, and whether the taxman feels that someone's been trying to pull a fast one or not. And clearly, in the case of Rangers dabbled at EBTs and then effectively, from the outside, it appears that they may have got greedy and just pushed and pushed and pushed, and that's why they built up this huge backlog and potential liability.
Well, whatever you think of it, it's an incredibly sticky situation and quite a sad one as well. All right, time now for some quick hits. Who's excited? Fabrice Muamba is reportedly doing much better as of Monday, and we're all grateful for that. But meanwhile, Bolton defeat Blackburn 2-1 and crawl out of the relegation zone. Rory, are they staying up?
I think it's between them and QPR. I think Wolves will go. I think Wigan, despite their heroic victory at Anfield on Saturday, will go, unfortunately. And I think a lot will depend on whether Bolton can take advantage of QPR's incredibly hard running.
And Djibril Cisse getting himself sent off all the time, but we'll get to that in a minute. Liverpool lose at home to Wigan. Dicko, they now have 3 points fewer than they did at this stage last year when a man named Roy Hodgson was in charge, although not by this phase of the season, and the fewest number of home wins since the early 1950s when they were relegated. Brutal question, since you have neither Scouse accent nor particular Liverpool allegiances, unlike some, is it time to rethink Kenny?
Well, for Kenny to rethink, or for Liverpool to rethink whether they should have him as manager.
I mean, the latter.
This is proving that Hodgson, you know, is a decent manager who had problems at Liverpool, and that Kenny is a, you know, okay manager, but not the messiah that he was painted when he came in. You know, he's addressed a few issues, but has also made some clanging mistakes. And I think he'll continue into next season because Fenway will bottle it. But I don't think he's going to turn Liverpool into a Champions League team, no.
Oh, this negativity. Arsenal demolish an awful Aston Villa side, but Theo Walcott scores a great goal and a place in next year's Champions League now looks certain. Julien, I remember you being rather critical of Monsieur Wenger earlier this year. Will you maintain your rabidly anti-French stance, or will you eat humble pie and explain just how Wenger managed to turn things around for the Gunners?
I still think he made some mistakes at some point, and for example, not recruiting any fullbacks in January, even on loan. But I do have to give him credit for turning things around so well. You know, he stick with someone like Walcott, for example, when he was not really in confidence, and obviously, you know, he kept great faith in that team, in the formation he played on, and you know, and gave a good boost to the players when they needed to. So credit to him for turning things around.
And now Walcott's a superstar again, so we give credit to Arsene Wenger. Martin Jol was rather frank this weekend, saying that if his prized trio of Clint Dempsey, Moussa Dembélé, and Brady Hangeland wanted to leave, he wouldn't stand in their way. Albeit, of course, they'd have to leave at the right price. Rory, I know you're cut out for this. Why don't you play matchmaker? Give me a realistic transfer fee for each and tell me where you think they would be a good match.
Okay, so Dempsey's contract is up in the summer of 2013, so I think he'd get you maybe $5 million. Which I think would be an absolute bargain for Tottenham or Liverpool. Moussa Dembélé, probably a little bit more, maybe 10, 12 in a slightly depressed market, plus he doesn't have a final ball. I would say somewhere like, I mean, to be honest, yeah, Liverpool or Tottenham again would probably do quite well to have him, one of the two for each, let's say. And then Breda Handeland, knocked on a bit now, isn't he, Handeland? 6, maybe 7, someone like Everton, maybe Newcastle. But to be honest, I think he could do a lot worse than just stay at Fulham. He seems to fit in there. He's not good enough to play for a Champions League team, so I wonder if he maybe should stay.
There you go. Teams out there looking for a director of football, Rory K. Smith might be available at the right price. Newcastle win again, this time against West Brom and Roy Hodgson, the man who used to be the next England manager. Dicko, we've been waiting for them to collapse all season long. I asked for your percentage chance of them qualifying for the Champions League earlier, so I won't ask you that. But instead, I will ask you what I ask people about Newcastle every single week. How on God's green earth do they keep winning with Williamson and Perch at the back and Coloccini and Taylor get injured and everything goes wrong and Papiss Cisse stretchered off and yet they still win? What is it?
I was going to say, in true journalist fickle fashion, I gave them 10% chance early in the of getting the Champions League, and I could just raise it to 20% because, you know, 10 minutes have passed and we changed our mind. And I actually look at their fixture list and they must have the easiest run in of all of those big, ever those Champions League contending teams, don't they? So I'm going up. I'm raising them to 15%.
Newcastle fans, Dicko's on the bandwagon. He's getting on. QPR lose at Sunderland after Djibril Cisse gets himself foolishly sent off. Not for the first time this season. It's happened before. It could well happen again. Julien, you have two options. You can defend your insane countryman, just as I always defend my own insane countryman, Mario Balotelli, or you can tell me what Mark Hughes should do to him, and please make it as violent and graphic as possible.
Listen, he will be banned for 4 games, so there'll be only 4 games left. He should stay home for the last 4 games of the season so he can realise how stupid he was again this weekend for that tackle that could cost a lot to his team. And maybe he can reflect on all of that to start next season in a better sort of way and better moods.
In the championship?
In the championship. because he could have cost his team safety for sure.
You know, is he a bit loopy, or is this out of, because he seems like a nice enough guy.
He is, but he's very passionate, I think, and I think he's sort of like he's loving already QPR and the fans and everything, and he got so passionate that sometimes he do very stupid things. He's not the brightest either, so
I'm sure he appreciates you saying that.
Gabriele, one for you. Milan versus Barcelona is the pitch of this week's Champions League games. How do they do on at the weekend?
Well, it was a tale of two teams at the weekend, Rory K. Smith. Milan beat Roma 2-1. I thought they were somewhat fortunate to do so, because Roma went out there to attack and took the lead and then just kept attacking, and Milan kind of nailed them. Penalty for the first one, and then got them on the break for the second one. But the big news for Milan is that Thiago Silva is out, which is a tremendous blow. He will likely miss both the first and second leg, which makes their prospects rather bleak. As for Barcelona, they had a rather tough away game. And of course, no Abidal, no Dani Alves. Dani Alves will be back for the Champions League. Abidal, of course, will not. But hey, you know, they got their 2-0 win that they needed, and they trudge on. Thiago, by the way, got sent off in that game. I still think Barcelona pretty stuck on to make the semifinal, and setting up a wonderful rematch against Chelsea. That's all we've got time for this week, but remember, you can go to thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, the web chats. Rory, is your web chat on Mondays?
It is on Mondays.
And Dicko, you do a web chat too, right?
Thursdays.
There you go. Most days of the week, you can web chat to your favorite Times writers, and not just them, but Rory as well. You can also follow us all on Twitter. We're all on there. It's been a privilege having you with us. So, till next week. Bye-bye.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.